All right. What's up, everybody? This is Alexander Juan Antonio Cortez. This is the Art of Health podcast. I have a guest with me today, gentleman, Mr. Rollo Tomasi. Hopefully I said that right.
Yeah.
The author of The Rational. All right, cool. Mm-hmm. Author of The Rational Male. I'm going to assume you guys know who he is. I'm not going to do a long intro. He's written Rational Male, Volume 22 and 3, kind of the godfather of the red pill, which, again, I'm going to assume my audience kind of knows what it is. We just been having a conversation right now, so I'll let him kind of do a little bit of an intro, Rollo. How you doing?
Good. I think we were going to talk about what physique and the physical aspect of things on this talk. Is that what we're going to do?
Yeah, something along those lines. So, I mean, you guys have been listening a while now. I've been in the fitness industry 9 years. I've known the highest levels of physique competitors, bodybuilders, powerlifters, those types of people. Like I was just saying. But yeah, there's this factor to that where when people think of the word alpha, it's such a charged thing now. But there's a physical presentation to that. Does he look alpha?
Right.
But I've seen over my lifetime, and obviously you got more life experience than I do, that you have to have the inner game. You have to have the way of being, the personality to back up the look.
Right.
For a lot of guys, even for ones who I think conception themselves as being the macho alpha male, they can turn to absolute chumps with women. And their appearance, it gets some attention and points that way.
Right.
But then it all breaks down the actual relationship dynamic.
Yeah, well, I was going to say is that there has to be I don't want to say this is attributable only to pickup artists, but there's a certain idea of congruency. There has to be, if you're a big yoke dude, nobody wants to see you in, dressing like you're in, like you're a little girl, they don't want to see you like, and I think the easiest way to describe this is if you see a dude who's like really super yoked and he's dressed up in like a bikini or something like that, a woman's bikini, that's incongruent, because you have this guy who's really yoked and who in another context would be very, very hot and women would be all over that, but he ruins the congruency. And that's just one aspect of that. The other aspect is like making your life fit around, who you are as opposed to what you are. So if you're, again, I think we were talking, or I think this whole conversation started with a tweet that I was telling you about. There's a guy I used to know named Jake, and I put him in one of my essays. And this guy was just drop dead model quality, gorgeous guy. And yet, and I think he was a publicist for this one casino I was working with. And he had access to lots and lots of women. He had access to, just model quality women too. And they would just fall all over themselves for him. But he was always upset because he couldn't get a girlfriend and he couldn't get anything to go, longer. And then just hanging out with the guy and understanding what he was all about, his looks were not congruent with what women were expecting, that a guy that looks like that, he was different from what they were expecting from that guy. So if he's this, even if he's the most yoked out guy that you can possibly imagine, he's still, if he acts like a pussy or if he acts like he's beta, that's a knock against you. Now there's a lot that the physique can cover. There's a multitude of sins that, looking really good can cover. But after a while, when that kind of builds up, it ruins the package. It ruins the whole idea of what that guy, the fantasy of what that guy could be.
Mm-hmm.
And like we were talking before we came on here, I was telling you about my other friend who's a bodybuilder. He was one of my training partners for, probably about 10 years back. And his name was Dean. And this dude was like 6'2", maybe 6'3". Gorgeous looking dude. I mean, just yoked, did male stripping on like once a month at one of these strip clubs where they would have the all male review. And he was telling me, I was telling him, I said, well, yeah, you make a lot of money at that because you're a good looking dude. And he wanted to get me to do it. And I'm like, I don't have to do that. but I was like, I mean, this is a long time ago.
Yeah.
But I told him, I'm not going to do that. He says, well, The key to being an effective male stripper is not just having a good body. It is also selling a fantasy that goes along with that, because what arouses men and what arouses women are two different things. You can look at a girl in, a thong and a bikini, and you can see a chick on, strippers in like female strippers in the strip club. they got the easiest job in the world because all they got to do is just be, you know, sexually available, and they got to be hot. They don't have to do much else after that. I mean, they just they got to flirt with them and everything.
But, I've trained a few in my day. It was interesting listening to them.
Yeah. Well, for a male stripper, they have to sell something more than just their body. I mean, it's nice to have that body. And I'm sure that there are some women who are just going to, you know, go, okay, well, it looks good. But the more successful that male stripper was, he had to sell his body plus the fantasy. So it wasn't just the hot male stripper. It was the hot male stripper who was the hot fireman or the hot attorney. And I was telling you this before, is like the most profitable fantasy was the officer and a gentleman fantasy. So the guy would be in his dress blues and then strip it off and then go into his routine. And they're selling the story and the fantasy along with that. And again, really what that is that's congruency. It's like, okay, yeah, the guy's hot, but is he believable? Is the guy really, is he really like this? No, probably not, but we're going to engage in fantasy right now anyways. Is he really a fireman? No, but if he's selling it in a fireman's costume, that is more arousing for women than it would be for, you know, if there's a discongruity or incongruency between those.
Yeah, I was incongruent myself when I was younger, mm-hmm. since I was, I mean, you know, typical story for a lot of guys. I was, you know, kind of like alpha beta-ish. You know, I'm 6'2", like, you know, a little over 6'2".
Yeah.
Always, you know, been a good-looking guy, got attention just for the way I looked, didn't have the personality go with it. So I always got female attention. Women will talk to me. So that was always easy. Mm-hmm. But when I was younger, you know, especially teenage years, I couldn't back it up. I was just, you know, I was passive, you know, white knight mentality.
Right.
And I was always, you know, pissed off, thrown off. I remember being those days because I'd see guys that were, you know, not as good-looking as me, shorter, what have you. But, you know, they'd be, you know, typical stuff, aggressive, didn't care, did what they wanted. And they got that. They got the sexual female attention, and I got right. you know I got friend zoned over and over. And it took right. me. I had to go through this period of, you know, trying to figure out why. And, you know, like you just said with the congruency, I've seen. I mean, one of a good friend of mine I had in the fitness industry. He was a probably similar to Jake. Was it like a, you know, professional bodybuilder? Mm-hmm. Looked, this guy was just astounding looking, and he obviously was very. He pre-selected a certain genre of women who wanted that look, so he did not mm-hmm. appeal to everybody. But he had this availability of, you know, fitness chicks, you know, who would, you know, want to be with him, and he was financially successful. His whole model, though, of having a girlfriend was to immediately turn it into a soulmate situation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So his persona that was very bravado macho, as soon as you liked him a little bit and went on 3 dates, you know, you were going to be the one.
Mm-hmm.
He got dumped over and over, and he could not figure out why for the life of him.
Yeah, that's exactly what Jake used to do. He would find these chicks, and they'd be happy to sleep with him, like same night lays. They were happy to be with him. But again, once he got into the second date or the third date, exactly what you're saying, it was this sort of verbal diarrhea where it's just like, you know, he spills his guts and lets it, you know, okay, baby, you know, you're the woman I've always looked for in my life. And you know, suddenly that any woman was a one-itis to him. And he really wanted that really badly. But like, the funny thing is like, he was so good looking, he would get like that higher tier woman. And the higher that woman is like on her sexual market value, the more, I think, expectations that woman is going to have. So she's not just expecting the hot guy. She's expecting the hot guy with ambition. She's expecting the hot guy who is going to be an entrepreneur, who's going to, you know, build something out of himself. There's got to be some sort of value added along with that guy. And so he would get into that, and then he would make the mistake. And I tried to coach him on this too. I would say, look, dude, breadcrumbs, man. You just got to leave freaking breadcrumbs and let them unravel you. Because once you do that, you're not a mystery to them anymore. You know, you're never going to get anywhere with these chicks. I said, and then, you know, the girls that wanted to have something like long-term with him, they weren't good looking enough as the girls he was getting like on a nightly basis. So he could easily hook up with like a 7 or 6 or 7, and she'd probably be happy to, you know, live the rest of her life with him and just sort of, you know, coddle him along because she's so not unused to being able to get a guy who's probably 1 or 2 points above her mm-hmm. in SMV. But he didn't want those girls. He wanted the hot girl who was, you know, going to be his soulmate and going to be his one-itis. And that is because the dude has been taught from a very early age, all this Disney shit, all this Pollyanna stuff, all this, you know, there's only one person in the world for you. And it was so, the biggest fight I ever got into this guy with was over the fact that there is no one, like there's no soulmate. I'm telling you, it's like, look, dude, like all these girls, and I approved it to him. I said, how many girls have you been with that have been your soulmate already? I said, they're not your soulmate. I said, there's some good ones and there's some bad ones, but there is no one. And he just got really upset about that because that's the way they're brought up. And the blue pill really caused that incongruency in what would otherwise be a guy who was going to be very, very successful with women and in life in general too.
I call it like the Disney Prince complex. You know, there's a Disney princess, there's a Disney prince.
Yes.
Yes. What I've seen, you pointed this out for, you know, even the guys that engage and, you know, I'm not a PUA guy, but obviously there's merit to being able to, you know, have a social interaction that goes your way.
Right.
But the sort of the concept I think of, you know, like, what does it mean to be good with women? Mm-hmm. It's not hard to get laid provided you check off a certain number of boxes. It's not an impossible task. Mm-hmm. But you have these guys, especially the ones that have, you know, the alphaness, at least in terms of appearance, where I realized this when I was talking with my buddy, like he assumed, like, by his definition, he was good with women because they were attracted to him. Mm-hmm. Sex was fairly easy. Mm-hmm. Relationship stuff, he could get bitched down to a corner within seconds and, you know, couldn't protest.
Right.
Yeah, so then, yeah, it breaches this broader question of, like, okay, if you're going to be good with women, is it just the sexual dynamic of, you know, getting the girl into bed, or is there everything else that comes after? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that initial stage of improving yourself, getting your stuff together that way, I don't know that that's that difficult.
One thing I've noticed now, and just to give you a little bit of personal background, yeah. I mean, I used to play in bands in the Hollywood rock scene back in the late 80s and early 90s. I had hair longer than yours, blonde down to my ass. And I played in some, you know, semi-pro bands back in the day, but that was my shtick. I was in good shape. Don't get me wrong. I was in really good shape, but it was like, I had that, you know, really rail thin, definition, but never really a bodybuilder. But my brother my younger brother, was an amateur circuit bodybuilder for a long time. And so we were always kind of like going back and forth between, you know, each other's sort of social groups. And so, you know, in doing that, I became familiar with some of his friends who were also these very good looking guys who would hook up with these girls who, for them, if it was going to be a long-term thing, it was almost guaranteed that if the guy was really, really good looking, his girlfriend was going to be like one or two steps beneath him on sexual market value. Very few were there. Did I see, like, you know, Fitness America, you know, contestant with a guy who was really yoked. I know that happens. And I see that all the time. I know that that definitely happens. But the guys that we were hanging out with at that time, it was guys who, again, were really incongruent with their alphaness. They're very alpha on stage, and when they're amongst each other, and they're like, you know, like guys, you know. But then when as soon as they get with their girls, like, yes, honey, you know, and their women as a result of that became very, very possessive of them. So if they were going out with the guys, or if they had, you know, if they're out later than an hour, you know, from their curfew or whatever it was supposed to be, they were calling him up and saying, where are you? Are you at the strip club? Are we, you know, it was really possessive, crazy jealousy, because those women knew that they had a guy that was, you know, a step above or two steps above where they were. And so it made them almost crazier. And then that really fed in to the really unhealthy relationship between the really good looking guy and the sort of, you know, not bad looking woman, but like less good looking on a scale wise than that guy. And so it kind of had this really negative feedback loop between the woman and the good looking guy, because first of all, she's jealous as hell. She thinks that everybody's out for her man, because, I mean, think about it, you know, in terms of hypergamy, she's hit the jackpot, you know, and she doesn't want anybody grabbing her man. And so that sort of feeds into, you know, mate guarding from a woman's side of things. And then if the guy's already blue pill to begin with, what's he going to do? He's going to keep trying to find ways to go, okay, honey, it's all right. Don't worry. I'm not out there fooling around on you. I'll be home. And turning into even worse, really turning into a guy that she's not going to be able to respect no matter how good looking he is. You know, she's hot. She likes to have sex with him. But when you're living with that guy and he's constantly pandering to the girlfriend, yeah, and again, it creates this really unhealthy negative, you know, feedback loop until the guy finally probably, you know, stops working out, or he doesn't go out with his friends anymore, he isolates himself more, he puts on some weight, he's not as good looking as he was before, and now what is he? He goes from being Superman to being Clark Kent, and she doesn't want that. And then what does she do? She goes off, she cheats with the next guy who's better looking than him, and that starts that shit all over again. Why? Because the guy doesn't have any congruency between his alpha physique and his alpha mindset.
That's an interesting point. I've noticed this as of late, where you've heard this, the suggestion of some guys where they'll tell you, like, you like, get a girl that's less attractive than you, she'll be more loyal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've thought about that for, I kind of mulled it over, but I realized there's something to that in the sense that when you have that discrepancy in sexual market value, you have a guy, mm-hmm. let's say, you have a guy that's an 8, and mm-hmm. the girl that's a 6, and she knows that she got way above her mm-hmm. level. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and women know that. For the man, not a delusion, but sort of this ignorance where you have this assumption of this girl's a 6. Well, she's more loyal and mm-hmm. She's more submissive. And she's not being that way because you are really leading the situation. She's that way because, she hit the hypergamy jackpot.
Yeah, because it's dread.
Yeah, so there's less for you to do. And by your perception, it's like, oh, well, I found a better girl than the girl that's an 8. Mm-hmm. But the girl that's an 8, like you point out, she has higher expectations for you. Right. So you got a low expectation woman, that got, lucky essentially in who she's going to fuck. Mm-hmm. Now you're in the situation where, despite that being the dynamic, you still screw it up because you're still within the BP mindset. Mm-hmm. But by your definition, for the guys I've seen, they think they did good. It's like, oh, well, she's great. And I'm like, that's going to break down three, four, five, 6 years as you start to slack off, since you will, mm-hmm. because she's not keeping you on your toes, and she starts to resent you for it.
Right, right. Well, then what happens is you're constantly trying to qualify to her in a sense that you are loyal and you're a good guy, especially for a guy like, say, like Jake or somebody, or somebody who's already got this kind of one-eyed, so they're what I call pre-whipped. They're already, before they even get into a relationship, they know what they want to do when they get into that relationship. So they're like, I'm going to do everything I can. Or usually it's like, I'm never going to be like the way my dad was with my mom. They're trying to be a better man by being more obedient, by being more submissive, by being more supportive, but it's never really support. It's just, a guy sublimating his desires and his aspirations and his ambitions to make a woman feel like he's the guy that's going to be there and he's going to be the super dutiful guy. And I was told, so I was talking to Alan Roger Curry about this not too long ago. I told him, I said, women don't want a man to cheat, but they love a man who could cheat. Mm-hmm. And if you couldn't, you get to the point where you start out your relationship and the woman knows you could cheat. And then you basically march it back and march it back and march it back until you lose her respect and you become a guy who could never cheat on her. And that's when she loses interest in you, because there's nothing to keep that, well, first of all, the mystery and everything, but that kind of indignation or that kind of suspicion. I mean, I call it dread, but and I think that there's really two kinds of dread. There's really overt dread, which I think guys sort of mistake as being, in any, some way helpful. And in certain situations, it can be. And what I mean by overt dread is like giving ultimatums or telling your woman, say, look, if you don't do what I say, I'm out, that kind of thing, like straight, back and forth. That's overt dread. And I know some guys can do that because they're in a position either financially or they're good looking enough or whatever to be able to pull that off. And I understand that, but I think really the more effective form of dread is passive dread. And that's when you are so good looking that women look at you, and when you're at a restaurant or you're out at a club or you're somewhere on vacation or something, and women are looking at you, and your woman is picking up on that. She sees a lot more subcommunications than guys do, for sure. So when she sees that instills a passive dread, and what that means is that when somebody says, hey, your man is really good looking, blah blah blah, or he's really stepping up, or he's really doing something, they any kind of compliment becomes almost a point of tension or point of anxiety. And it's like, and it's just third party dread. It's not you trying to initiate that. It's somebody else coming in from the outside. And I think that's always going to be much more effective than direct. But when that's a constant thing, when a woman is, you're saying, if you're an 8 and she's a 6, and then there's this constant over and over and over again where she's having to deal with women, being attracted to her man, it's interesting, because I think when women want a guy who's like that, but yet there's a certain amount of insecurity that comes with a guy who's two steps above them. And so they're constantly dealing with mate guarding, first of all, and that's inspired by dread. And then it's like they can't believe their luck, on top of that. They can't believe that they're with this person. And they're always trying to find ways to consolidate on that. And I can't begin to tell you how many guys I know who have had accidental pregnancies with their six while he was an eight, because she's trying to lock him down. And the only reason that happened was because he was just simply too stupid or too blue pill to understand that that was a possibility, because I think that when we're young, especially these days, when we're feminizing boys to become feminized young men, that we want to turn them into somebody who's going to be that ideal beta provider when they get older and they get to the point where a woman finally needs them. And I think that sort of it festers in a guy, or it matures later on from being that kind of youthful, idealism up to the point where they're going to be like this perfect, dutiful husband, no matter what even if it's a single mother or whatever, but they're already prepared for that. Like we were talking before, the guy is pre-whipped. He's already knows that he's going to get into that situation before he's even met a woman to get in the situation with. Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, there's something I'm going to toot my own horn here. I call it sort of like the Fabio effect for myself.
Oh yeah.
Like having long hair, just looking how I looked, I realized that I prompt a certain level of dread just even in approaching a woman. I've had guys ask me, it's like, do you get more girls looking like you? I'm like, I get more female attention. But the reality is that for the vast majority of women, when if I approach them and they have the presumption that I'm already better looking than them, my hair is nicer than theirs. Mm-hmm. Oh, I can't hold on to them. I can't keep them. So that happens. So like the dread game is always present, whether I want it or not. Mm-hmm. What I've seen happen, like my own family, when the dread completely dissipates is, you've probably seen this too, where you have the guy where he's getting bitched at by his wife in some kind of argument, and that insult gets thrown out that, who would want to be with you but me?
Right, yeah, exactly. It's like
I crack up when I hear
that. And what's funny is that's kind of, it's interesting how that sort of comes as a natural threat or a natural shaming, because when you hear something like that, it's almost always it's a spoken recognition of what everybody sort of, silently keeps to themselves, and suddenly it's like, no, you're never going to get anybody as good as me. That's a real, I think a lot of guys are, again, preconditioned to think that. They're preconditioned to think that if they have a girl and she has this, perfect, what I call a genetic celebrity, she's a really good looking girl that, is far above what he thinks is his league. And that's why guys like get into this habit of like self-deprecation about themselves. Like they say, oh, I can't believe my wife or my girlfriend would, lower herself to be with such a schmuck like me. And it doesn't matter if that guy's like really, he might be, right with her in sexual market value. She's an eight, he's an eight. That guy is going to self-deprecate himself anyways. And what happens is when he does that, he convinces her that he's not the guy that she should be with anyways. Because women, when it comes to guys, women pick guys that are a complement to their egos, or they would like to anyways. When they're, especially with a good looking guy, what that says about that woman is that she says that I'm the kind of girl that could get this kind of guy, right? So when you've got a woman who's like, say, a six and the guy's an eight, I think that woman has a real tough time with that, because she realizes that this guy is way above her own league. So she can't really play on that. And she can't really say, you're never going to get anybody as good as me, because they both know that that's not true. But when you have an eight and an eight, or a nine and an eight, and the guy is constantly self-deprecating, what he's doing is he's deprecating his own sexual market value. Because remember what we were talking about before, there has to be a fantasy that goes along with it. There has to be something more. There has to be value added to the guy that goes beyond his good looking, qualities. And so when you're constantly doing that, you're deprecating your own value. And the woman goes, well, if I could find somebody better, then why wouldn't I go find somebody better? And really what it comes down to is, when a woman is with a guy, that guy, like I said, is representative of the kind of guy that she can get. So, like, just a quick story here. I had a friend who was not the best looking dude in the world. He was actually a bass player in his band that I was in once. And he had a wife, or he had a girlfriend, and then his wife, who was really I don't say abusive, but she would really browbeat him, and you could tell he was the beta and she was the dominant partner in the relationship, right? And so she'd constantly do that. And then right up until somebody in the band or one of his friends would come up and say, yeah, would try to hit him up about his manhood, right? They say, you need to man up and stop being such a pussy, da, da, da. That was when his wife would go ballistic, because she would go, how dare you? He's more of a man than any of you guys. And would just come to his aid. And just like this woman who was just browbeating him half an hour before, and you talk even just slightly marginal shit about him, then she would jump up in front of him and say, he's more of a man than you. And just start, you know, going in on how great he is. And I got to thinking about that, you know, once I was sort of more red pill, and I go, you know what? That's because she's with this guy and she doesn't want other people to think that he is so much of a schmuck that she can't get anybody better, because her ego is associated and intimately invested into the guy that she's with. So if the guy is constantly saying, oh, I'm so lucky to have you, I can't believe you would go for somebody like me, I mean, you say that enough times, and yeah, she's going to believe that, because she's making that association of, is this really the best kind of guy that I can get? And that, I always say, is, you know, that's all comes back to hypergamy, because hypergamy is based in doubt. And it's constantly this, like, have you seen the cartoon? I think it was a cartoon of this woman, she's sitting naked on the bed, on the side of the bed, and laying down, sleeping next to her is Superman, because you can see his super suit, you know, hanging over the chairs and stuff like that. And the caption is he really the best that I can get? And I was like, I don't know where it is right now, but that is the perfect analogy of hypergamy. It's like, you can have Superman sleeping next to you in bed and women will still think, can I do better? Can I get a little bit better than this guy? And really, again, like I was just saying, it comes back to that ego association with the guy that she's with.
Well, there's that social conditioning, like you said. I realize this, like, I mean, so much of the, you know, female primacy narrative, but as a guy, just for anyone that's grown up in the last 40 years, it's been drilled into your head over and over again that you're so lucky to be with your wife. You're so lucky to be the girl. I can't believe she chose me. She chose me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or the woman is the one that apparently, you know, was the executive decision in the relationship.
Yeah.
That gets put into you over and over and over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. You know, even for the guys that, like you said, embody themselves to be alpha, that, you know, lack this congruency, you undermine your whole relationship time and time again. And at the same time, I've had male clients who are very hyper successful, money, looks, status. They get into relationships with women where, you know, you could call it a gold digger scenario, but she got the alpha. Who's going to provide everything for her? But he has that persona within him still, like, oh, I got so lucky that she, she appreciates me for me. Mm-hmm. And then she cheats on him with the guy that, someone who is, you know, far below his status.
Mm-hmm. And that's the guy who goes, I can't believe she did this. I can't believe it. How, you know, it's just out of the blue, just blindsided me. She turned on me. I couldn't believe it. That's an interesting dynamic as well. Because when guys are constantly deprecating themselves, they think that is a way to do two things. First of all, it's to boost their wife's esteem, right? They think that by making themselves less, it makes her more. It doesn't. You make yourself less and she wants you to be more. But we've been taught and we've been conditioned by the blue pill and just this feminization for the last four or five generations to constantly defer to women. And we think that the more we defer and the more we identify with women, the more they're going to like us. And so there's never even an afterthought for these guys to think that maybe I'm better. Maybe I'm the one that she's lucky to be with me. And imagine those guys who are cocky enough to go and say, yeah, she's lucky to have me. And then of course everybody laughs. Oh, you're a joke. But the fact of the matter is like, if you do that and you're being cocky enough, women like that. They like it because they know that this guy, even if it's irrational self-confidence, it's still self-confidence. And the guy, you know, thinks more of himself than womankind. And I think that really, you know, from a very early age, boys as early as 5 years old are being taught to defer and to put womankind on a pedestal. So when the guy gets later on in life and he's married, what's he going to do? He's just going to take that same deference. He's going to apply it to his wife. You know, maybe it was his girlfriend. Maybe it'll be his daughter after that. But he's constantly deferring to the feminine, or the I call it feminine imperative, but just making womankind above him. And so, like, I one of the most aggravating things for me is to listen to these evangelical Christian guys constantly refer to their wives as their brides, and they constantly say, "I can't. You know, I'm so lucky that God put me with this woman because she's so much better than me. She's so much more closer to God. She's so much more, and she's so good looking. I mean, look at me, look at her. She's beautiful." You know, and trying to give her compliments, shower her with compliments. But those compliments don't mean shit from a guy who's down here and she's up here. So, and then the last thing I was going to say is that, the whole thing about luck and the whole thing about fate and everything else, it goes back to women trying to be these unknowable creatures. And so therefore men have to go, well, you know, I don't know why she would be with me. So it must be God or fate, or I got lucky. I mean, that's what we even call it that. If you get laid, you would say, "Hey, did you get lucky? Why are we saying it's not luck, man? Maybe it's skill. Maybe I actually know what the fuck I'm talking about." You know? And we don't think of it in those terms because we're conditioned to think that a woman's sexuality is such a prize, and it is such, you know, this high level thing that you can, you know, it feeds guys' egos because some chick wanted to have sex with them. I mean, get the fuck out of here, man. I mean, this has been happening for, you know, 100,000 years. Men and women have been coming together and having babies and stuff like that. It's not luck, okay? There's something else to it. It's not luck. But we call it luck, and we call it like some sort of supernatural metaphysical reason. And I think that guys even defer back to that because they think that if they do that, then first of all, it's some kind of insurance that their woman's not going to leave them, like you were talking about before. And then second of all, it goes back to this unknowability of women. I've had older guys come to me and they'll elbow me and they'll talk about women. I go, "Hey, women, I guess we'll never figure them out." It wants you to laugh along with that. I'm like, "No, dude, I'm pretty good at this. I think I've got this pretty much figured out. It's you who don't, and you're 65 or 70 years old and you haven't figured it out yet." So maybe that seems cute and endearing to your wife, but it's not cute and endearing to anybody else.
Yeah. I keyed on that recently. I mean, I have a weird background. So I was from 16 to 21, roughly. I grew up around women, like ballet world, dance. Mm-hmm. I was around girls all the time. I call it the land of women because I was in a position where they weren't changing their behavior because I was there. Mm-hmm. So you see women talk to them how they are themselves. And that, I mean, honestly, women were, that was the thing that red-pilled me more than anything else, because I realized all the, you know, Disney Prince delusions I had from, let's say, you know, being born to age about 15, mm-hmm. it just got destroyed. It just got completely wrecked sideways, but you know, in a good way. But that's when I've been one of the, that point of women being unknowable. Mm-hmm. After a while, I didn't find them mysterious at all. It was the most predictable set of behaviors because I think more women are implicit, but mm-hmm. seeing that now, and I get that from guys now, can you ever really understand women, you know, like what you just said, who truly knows? Yeah, you can. It's pretty obvious. They tell you what they're going to do all the time. There's not mystery to this.
You know, Stephen Hawking's just died. And it's funny because when he died, the first thing that came to my mind was this quote that I remember, you know, distinctly. I went back and copied it and put it in a tweet. And it says, "The greatest mysteries of the universe is woman," right? Is woman, right? And I'm like, here's this dude who is probably one of the highest IQs on planet. I mean, he's up there. I don't know if this is a fact or not, but he's up there with Einstein, okay? The guy is freaking smart.
160.
And still, the guy is deferring to women because that is what he was taught from very early age. Don't try to figure him out. Nobody can know women. And again, so what do? We say, well, it must be fate, or it must be, I can't figure him out, so it must be the gods are smiling upon me and I got with this woman. And let me ask you something. So I know you do ballet. Does anybody ever give you shit and call you Kip Winger?
No, actually not.
You know who Kip Winger is, though, right?
Wait, no.
Okay, Kip Winger. Kip Winger was the bass player and singer for the band, the heavy metal band Winger. I don't even call him heavy metal. The rock butt rock band Winger, right? Mm-hmm. And long haired dude. And the guy, once his sort of musical career was over, he went to ballet and he started doing ballet dancing and stuff. And so people would say, "Oh gosh, Winger, you know. I just wondered if they were gonna, if somebody gave you grief about being Kip, because you got the long hair and everything. Yeah. I was like,
oh. No, I had no idea. I mean, I get called stuff so much all the time. You know, WWE guys, Tarzan, Fabio.
Yeah, I know. I get what, you know, it's funny you should say that. I just give you a background about myself too. Like I was saying, I, you know, when I was in my, gosh, from the time I was about 16 till right about 30 years old, I had hair at least as long as yours, maybe a little bit longer. And it was, I bleached it blonde all the time. And that was my thing. That was my look. And my game at that time, you know, I didn't know what game was. Of course, you know, this is way, you know, we're talking like late, well, I just say early 90s. My game was going, you know, for the longest time, I was very, very blue pill in my high school years. And then I had a girlfriend, got my soul crushed by the, you know, because she was my one-itis. I went through all that stuff. Wow. And then later, you know, I was living in Hollywood at the time. So I'm like, why wouldn't I? You know, I was a musician. I'm like, why wouldn't I go out there and do it? And I certainly wasn't in music to make a lot of money. It was because I could regularly go out and I could get laid. And that was what I was really mostly focused on. And it was fun to go out there and, you know, I mean, it's not that I didn't love the music. I do love the music, but it was, you know, if there was a purpose, a latent purpose for it, it was so I could get laid. And I did exactly the same thing you did. Like when I would go out there and I would get IOIs or indicators of interest from women all the time. And it was very easy. It became almost like mechanical after a while. Mm-hmm. Because I would see some chick, she would give me that look and I would know the look, and then she'd hold the, you know, the eye contact for a beat longer. I'd go over and talk to her. Hey, how's it going? And whatever. I wasn't really a big drinker back then. And so I might have one drink in my hand for the whole night because first of all, I'm a starving musician. I got no money. And so it was probably a drink some other girl bought me, and I'd have that drink. And so I'd nurse the thing the whole night, and I would be, you know, chatting up a girl at a bar, and I'd leave my drink on the bar, and I say, hey, I got to go do my set. I'm going to go play my set. Watch my drink for me. Right. And if I will come back and she was still there with the drink, I knew I was getting laid that night. it became that easy to do. But again, I got the same thing. You know, oh, you're Fabio, and people, you know, guys want to give you grief because, you know, here you are, you got long blonde hair and you're living a lifestyle that's, you know, seems pretty, you know, pretty freewheeling, I guess. But guys, you know, guys want to give you grief and they want to talk shit about you. And I think that's another, that might be actually a pretty good topic to talk about, is I think that good looking dudes, I think sort of in this day and age, I mean, cause remember I've gone from like the, you know, the late 80s all the way up to where we are now. And I think that the better looking a guy is right now, I think at least in the manosphere, they tend to get, I think, some uncalled for, you know, criticism just because they're good looking, you know, like, most guys, especially the guys from, pickup artists hate, or the guys that go in, they try to learn game and it doesn't work for them because they, for whatever reason, they didn't do whatever they were supposed to be doing. And the game didn't work for them. So what do they say? They say, oh, well, you're good looking. Of course it's going to work for you. And of course you're going to get laid. And so there's that kind of hate side of it too, that goes along with the guy who's good looking. So I think first off, if there's a good looking woman or there's a good looking guy, we tend to want to disqualify that guy. If we're walking down the street and you're walking with your girlfriend, or you're in a group of girls, or you're in a mixed sex group of people, and a good looking guy walks by and the women start going, oh yeah, hey, he's hot, you know, whatever. And they start talking amongst themselves. What's the first thing that guys say? We must be gay, right? Now, only guys that good looking are gay. But what is that? You know, that is, that's intrasexual combat is what that is. It's disqualifying that guy from the breeding pool by saying, well, yeah, he's good looking, but too bad he's gay because he wouldn't want to have anything to do with any of you girls, you know, because he only likes guys. And what do women do when a good looking woman comes into that situation? They get all catty and snotty and bitchy, and they go, oh, I bet she's a slut. Who, how could she wear that? You know, and mm-hmm. all this. And then for them, it's even worse because there's all this subcommunication that goes on along with that. But what are they doing? They're disqualifying that really good looking girl from the breeding pool, for the mating pool, because if she's a slut, she's not worth investing your time in, or maybe she has a disease, or maybe she would just cheat on you anyways. And they're trying to predetermine what that, because they know that this, as a sexual competitor, this woman outclasses all of them. Mm-hmm. So they have to find some way to disqualify her from guys going up to her and investing themselves into that. And so I think that, like, even today in the manosphere, there's sort of, I think that kind of goes on, but in other ways, I think that there's a side of the manosphere, and I think I would really call you probably part of this too. There's that fitness side of it where guys are like, you know, here's how you get a six pack. Here's how you, you know, here's your nutritionist. Here's, and the great thing I think about manosphere today is we have such a breadth of different guys who can help in different aspects of the manosphere, in game and in working out, in finances. And that, you know, I'm glad you're coming to the, like I said, I told Anthony, I said, you really need to call AJ because, he's gonna, he has a side of the manosphere that I think we could really use in all of this. But, yeah, I mean, as far as the good looking stuff is concerned, as far as guys, you know, being hot guys, I always get into, and maybe you know this too, but I always get into these comment threads on my blog about how it's always good. It's nothing but looks. It's only looks are the only thing that matter. And if you're a good looking guy, you're going to be okay. You're going to find women. You're going to be all right. And then if you're not good looking, well, then you better make a lot of money or you better do something else. It's never game. It's never any kind of like, it's never mindset stuff. It's always about something extrinsic. It's always good look, you know, good looks or having a lot of money or, you know, and I tell guys, I've got a couple of essays. One of them is called Looks Count. And the other one is called Have a Look. And that Have a Look really kind of goes back to what we're talking about. Have a character, you know, women are looking for kind of a character in a guy. It's, you can't just be a regular guy. You have to be, you know, you have to be tribal tattoo guy, or you have to be long haired guy who's a ballet guy, or you have to be, you have to have some sort of character that you're playing, a tough brother from the city or, you know, that kind of thing. And then there's the looks count side of things where I tell guys, I said, look, you know, be good looking, you know, be attractive, have affluence or have game. I said, if you have two of those, you'd probably be okay. If you can have only one of those, only have a game is the most important part of that, is to have your mindset straight. Because I've seen guys, you know, go up and pick up and swoop on girls, really good looking girls, and pull them away from really good looking guys because they had more going for them. They had they would present a feeling. They started, you know, creating an emotional connection with that woman that even the hot guy wasn't necessarily doing. You know, once you get past that attraction point, what do you have past the attraction point? And so that's why I think that game is the most vital aspect of that. But being good looking or having a lot of money, what I think about those is I think that those are aspects of a guy that can cover for other deficits. Okay. So like I was telling you before with Jake. Yeah. So if the guy's really good looking and he's super beta, well, his good looking, his looks can cover that deficit. It can cover the fact that he doesn't have game or that he's kind of blue pill. And it's still going to get him laid. It might not get him a long-term girlfriend, but it's still going to get him laid. And there's guys that always tell me, oh, you got to have a lot of money. Well, chicks only care about money, or they only care about power or something like that. And I'm like, well, when I was 22 and I had like two fucking dimes to rub together and I had a beat up white pickup truck and, you know, the only assets I had was my amps and my guitars or something like that. I was slaying pussy, you know, left and right back then because I had what these women wanted. It wasn't about, you know, it wasn't about the amount of money that I had. It was who I was at that point and those kind of women who wanted to get with me. So, you know, and then just what you were saying a minute ago, the affluence and the money is not an insurance policy against, you know, your wife going to fucking pool boy because she's hot for that guy and she happens to be in the right phase of her ovulation and she wants to go after it. I'm thinking it's much better to have, you know, to have all of that, really. I mean, you want to be the complete package. You want to have everything. I'm not saying you have to necessarily do that for women, but getting women, if you are the complete package, if you got your ambition together and you got your life together and you're good looking and you keep your, you know, keep your physique going and you've got game and you're red pill aware and you've got all this stuff, maybe you're not doing that for a woman, but a woman is going to be a byproduct of that because you have put yourself together. So That's another thing. I kind of wish we had some call-in questions or something.
Yeah.
Because it's like, guys give me grief about this all the time. And I say, no, you need to have some way to cover deficits in other areas. So like my looks at the time when I was in my mid-20s covered the deficit of me not having any money and not having any, I was playing that role, but it covered that deficit. When you get a little bit of money, maybe that money covers another deficit for you. It could be personality or whatever. Like I see so many guys who are these really super alpha male guys, and they're alpha in the military or they're alpha in business, right? But as soon as they walk in the door to see their wives, they turn into these little sniveling little beta guys because they're taught to defer to women. So I think really what I'm trying to say here is that you need to have congruency. You need to have congruency between your good looks and your game, and then really your affluence and your own ambitions. And I think really where that starts is making yourself your own mental point of origin. Mm-hmm. You need to be the one that you think of first, and then you think of other people. I'm not saying be an asshole and be selfish and any of that stuff. I'm saying that you need to do that first, and then you can help somebody else. And I've said this before, as I'm a very a proponent of enlightened self-interest, which means I can't help anybody until I can help myself first. You know, they tell you when the oxygen masks come out of the airplane when they're decompression, they tell you to put the mask on yourself first and then put it on somebody else, because you can't help anybody if you're already passed out. So that's really, I think, making sure that you're your first order of thinking, and then working that into your ambition, working that into your looks, working that into other aspects of your life. As long as you're making yourself your first priority, are you doing it for women or are you not doing it for women? Are you doing it for self or are you not doing it for yourself?
Yeah, I've used the archetype model at times for that, where the one I've used like a lot, like the King archetype, where it speaks to guys on a level where you have to be able to lead yourself. Mm-hmm. If you're not leading yourself, then all other trappings fall apart from that. I was in a position myself even a few years back when I was 23, 24, I was living on my car, pretty much broke. I never had problems getting female attention, bring girls. I remember there was one point I was sleeping on somebody's couch and I literally was out and I told the girl, I'm like, yeah, I'm out of a place right now. Well, we can go back to my place. It wasn't an issue.
Yeah.
But I had the inner game confidence.
Yeah.
For things like the money or the looks or all that, I realize these guys, since I've gotten this question too, where guys ask, I've said the same criticism. Well, you're really good looking, so, it's easy for you. I'm like, no, I could be super beta, and it wasn't easy, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing. You create these false dichotomies. Mm-hmm. You essentially protect your own ego of why you think you're failing. If you had money, then it'd be easy for you. Well, if you were 6'5", then it'd be easy for you. Mm-hmm. It's not. Women are not universally attracted to all men. I think I wrote an essay about this that I think Craig James published. It was like late last year, but I essentially hit upon the concept of, when you have like an archetype of personality where you're a musician and you take that, to the edge where you're that guy. So you have game, you're a musician. That's attractive whether you are successful as a musician or not successful.
Right. Because you have play to your strengths.
Yeah. You have a persona to you. Well, the same thing if you're an artist and you paint. The same thing if you're, ballet dancer, that's intriguing to people. Same thing if you're high powered, military, that has a personality to where women are going to assume. Women, I think they'll sort of drop down an alpha, sort of an alpha setting of characteristics upon whatever the personality is. Mm-hmm. And whether the guy's, whether he's artistic, whether he's business, whether he's powerful, whether he's high status, they want to have the expectation that it's going to have this essentiality of alpha traitness with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then when you don't back that up, though, then, like you said, you go back to the incongruency factor, which if the thing I tell guys now, I'm an inner game model in that way, where I don't really worry. I don't focus. I'm not a game guy. I'm not a pickup artist. I'm not going to tell you how to talk to girls. If you don't develop your own masculinity as your own origin point, where you have, a general balance, let us say, of physically being confident, being able to communicate, putting yourself first, mm-hmm. having at least some stability where you can lead yourself, then women are always going to be frustrating to you because they're always going to be revealing your deficits.
Right. Well, when you look at, this would probably deserve a little bit of explanation here, because I get asked about this quite a bit, but in the second book, I have a chapter in there called Mental Point of Origin. And I always have to sort of to not redefine that, but sort of build that up. Because guys think, oh, well, it just means making yourself first or being selfish or being, I'm like, no. It's so much more than that, because most guys or most boys today, from the time that they're like 5 years old, are taught to defer to women. They're taught to be of use and utility to the mom, to carry the girl's books home from school, to, you know, don't beat up, don't never hit your sister, don't hit a girl. And then that builds from there. And I'm not saying hit a girl. I'm just saying that that's what guys or what boys are taught. And as a result of that, layer upon layer upon layer of this deference to women and womankind, you God forbid you wouldn't want to be seen as anything other than supportive of women, because you don't want to give anyone the impression that you're a misogynist. You don't want to say that, well, you're a real prick, or you don't respect women. That's the best one. You don't respect women. Well, mm-hmm. We can do a whole show on respecting women. But seriously, what happens is you boys are taught from a very early age to put layer upon layer upon layer of deference to women and womankind. And as a result of that, it is removing boys to men, their self-image, and making themselves important and concerning themselves with their ambitions, because they have to sacrifice more. And I, even Dr. Jordan Peterson goes into this quite a bit. He's all big about sacrifice. Uh-huh. And I'm of the opinion that sacrifice needs to be, you need to do some return on ROI on the idea of sacrifice. But we're constantly taught to sacrifice. We're constantly taught, we're already think of ourselves as disposable anyways. And so you've got this constant deference to the female, and it just, again, like, it keeps going and going and going, to the point where by the time a kid is, I would say, even maybe as early as 12, or maybe 14, that kid already puts women and girls and the interests of girls as the first thing he thinks of when a situation arises. If we're going to make a decision to all of us go out to, we're going to have pizza or we're going to go have a movie, what's the first thought that comes to that kid's mind is, what is the girl going to want to do? What is she going to, not what I want to do, what is the girl going to want to do? You know, how can I help the girl? How can we make whatever the girl wants to do happen? And like, you know, the classic thing where it's like the girl says, where do you want to go? And the guy says, I don't know, where do you want to go? I don't know, where do you want to go? That kind of stuff. That is exactly what I'm talking about. Because the guy, if you ever find yourself in that situation where you go into a restaurant and you say, okay, I want to go to this Mexican restaurant. She goes, eh, I don't know if I want to do that. Okay, I want to go to this Italian restaurant. Nah, I don't know if I want to do that. And okay, well, where do you want to go? I don't know, where do you want to go? The reason that you're even in that discussion is because you've made yourself, or you should say you've made women your mental point of origin, because you're thinking about that person first. You're not saying, hey, you look, I'm going to go to this Mexican restaurant. If you want to come along, you can. If not, fuck it, I don't care. You know, I'm going to go, and you're in my frame. You're in my world. It comes back to frame again. You're going to do, here's the offer. We're going to go rock climbing this weekend. Are you in? You know, and thinking that you're going to go do that no matter what, you're going to have fun. But I think that is a good illustration of mental point of origin. If your first thought is, how will this decision affect a woman? That is your mental point of origin. She is your mental point of origin. Womankind is your mental point of origin. Whatever. I'm not saying don't think about other people, but I'm saying that the first thought should be, what do I want to do this weekend? Hey, maybe I want to take so-and-so with me, right? So you're thinking about your first decision, or your first mental point of origin, the origin of which your thoughts originate, come from you and not from someone else. And I think that's probably the single hardest thing I have to deal with when I'm doing consults with guys, or when they ask me for advice, or what do you think is the worst thing going on, you know, that we're teaching our boys today? That is the worst thing that we're teaching boys today, is to not to make themselves their mental point of origin. Because naturally, most men and most guys, young boys even, put themselves as first. They think, oh yeah, well, I'm going to, you know, because they're out there, they're alpha, they're on the playground, they're doing whatever the fuck that they want to do. And then it takes a society and a media and a feminine imperative. It takes all of these extrinsic social forces to push himself out of his mental point of origin and to put womankind into his mental point of origin. And that, I think, is the number one thing. That if guys are going to unplug, that is the first step, is to make yourself, to think of yourself before you think of anything else.
Yeah, there's a meta point to this that I find interesting where, I was on a date a number of weeks back where the girl, I didn't go anywhere past a few dates. It wasn't interesting. But we had this conversation on our first date, and it was in the car. I basically told her, I'm like, you know what? We're going on a fancy date. I'm going to take you out. And actually, I wrote an email about it. I'm like, it was a fun time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I planned that out. I just told her we're going to do this. And that night going back to her place, she, it brought up a conversation. She's like, I love that you just told me what I was going to do. I didn't have to make a choice. Mm-hmm. And I've had so many women tell me that over the years. Mm-hmm. I'm so happy that you make the plans. So happy to have to choose. I love that you essentially are the one picking the direction all the time.
Because you're decisive and you're the dominant man. That's what women are looking for. Even the feminists who say that they're not. You put a guy in that situation, you look at women who tend to be dominant personalities, I'll guarantee you they had a weak father. I'll guarantee you, or an absent father entirely. And they don't understand that what they're really looking for is they're looking for a man to take charge. They're looking for a guy to make the make the reservations for dinner, make the reservations for whatever they're going to do, to have a plan. One thing I tell younger guys, if I get like a 16-year-old kid asking me, hey, how do I make an approach? How do I do this? I'll go into some detail, but I'll say, what are you going to do? What do you want to do first? I said, what if she says yes? What's your plan? Do you have a plan after that? 90% of these kids, I don't know. you need to have some sort of scheme and assume the sale. We'll always be closing, well, once you close, where are you going to go? What are you going to do about that? And exactly. I think that's that decisiveness. I tell a story quite often. I think I even told it. I saw you on Jesse Peterson, by the way.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty cool. I was on with him, I think, the week before you or the week after you. Mm-hmm. But one of the things Jesse asked me, especially with regard to this, was about, male dominance and just being not even so much assertive, but just having your shit together and knowing what you're going to do and like making yourself, having a woman come into your frame. That's what you were just talking about, is when a woman expresses her appreciation of that, she expresses that appreciation comes from you having your own world for her to enter into that she wants to be a part. She actively wants to be a part of it. And those are the beginnings, I think, of some very healthy relationships. But I told Jesse this when I met my wife. Up until that point, all the women that I had met and I had gone out with in any kind of long-term sense had always had their own cars. And if they did, they were the ones that were driving the car, right? And so if it was, we're going out, we're in my car, I drive, going out, she'd be driving. And I never really thought about this because, again, I was sort of in that egalitarian, equalist kind of mindset rather than a dominant, masculine mindset. And then when I met my wife, we were going out one time and we were taking her car and she hands me the keys. And I'm like, okay, I just went with it, right? I'm like, oh, I'm going to go with this. And later on, after we'd been going out for a while, I said, you always hand me the keys. I've never had anybody hand me the keys to do, when we were dating before. She's like, yes, because I expect you to be the man. I expect you to be the one who's, driving the car and drive. And that was really, has been kind of a metaphor for my entire relationship with my wife. I have been driving the car for us ever since. And I think that is really what, on a subconscious hindbrain limbic level, I think that's really what most women are looking for in a guy. And I say this too, it's dominance for sure, but it's competency. It's having a guy who's competent about a lot of things, like a guy who can change a tire and can go out and mow a lawn and go out and build a house and be competent at a great many things. Be an amateur plumber when he needs to be, go fix things around the house and fix things with her and fix things with, her family and that kind of, you got to have this overarching competency. And I really think that's written into women's evolutionary, psyche, into their firmware, that they're looking for a guy who can do all of that. And God forbid, you're the kind of guy that goes, well, I don't know how to fix the plumbing. I got to call somebody to come and help me do that. Or I got to seek out an expert for something. And if that's your first, impulse is to find somebody to do it for you rather than you do it yourself, I think that is sort of a hit to your competency when you're with them.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think the male point is going to make where you said, I'm talking about how men make from their male point of origin. Mm-hmm. When you're constantly asking women for like what the plan is, like I said, the young boys, you get this point where the first thing you think of is the girls. Mm-hmm. What if they don't like the place we're going to go eat? You're putting yourself into this incompetent role immediately.
Right.
So there's that factor. And at the same time, you're putting yourself into a position where the only way a woman can make you competent is to try to make use of you. Mm-hmm. And at the same time with that as well, I mean, this multi-layer, your ability to lead yourself is compromised since you've assigned women the role of being the planners to your own life. Mm-hmm. So, and you see that with, like the whole blueprint narrative plays out where many, I have a lot of guys contact me where they're trying to, kind of unplug themselves. And it's this unwrapping process where their whole sense of their being is predicated with the woman's role in like the narrative where, well, if I meet the girl, then she says this to me, then she, she chooses me. I was having this argument on Twitter a few days ago where this idea where like, women are the ones that select for sex. I'm like, I don't know that I fully agree with that. You can say like, okay, well, she let me sleep with her. I'm like, if no one chooses her, mm-hmm. she's not getting slept with by anybody. Right. Now, obviously men are always going to, men are always going to want pussy. So you could mm-hmm. say, well, females have the upper hand. I'm like, I think we give them that and we condition that into ourselves. Mm-hmm. And even in the unplugging process, if you can imagine, if a woman gets no attention at all, and that's the thing, women know this too with their SMV, a girl that gets no attention, she's not having the pick of the litter where any guy's going to be with her. It's whoever comes up to her.
Yeah. She has to take what she can get is what it is. Yeah. And you're right about that. I think that when, again, it's part of that being pre-whipped kind of thing. It always from, I mean, think about it this way. I've got this post right now and it's sort of an essay that analyzes how boys are raised from very early age to where, it's young men and how that's primarily molded by women and the feminine. Because if you look at the amount of teachers, the ratio of men to women teachers, I think it was even the United States, I think 77% of all teachers in the United States are female. And what are they doing? They're teaching, boys as if they're defective girls. And part of that is in that, again, that deference to the feminine, deference to, womankind, because even today we're teaching those kids, as if they are potential rapists or they could potentially be toxically masculine guys if we don't intervene and create, what I call the village. If the village doesn't come in and intervene, we're going to have this generation of rapists. And we're presuming that. And in that education, we sublimate, well, first of all, masculinity and the male gender to begin with. Like I said, they're treated as if they're defective girls, but they're also treated as if they are defective, meaning that they're not born as good humans.
Yeah, a good human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You probably saw that. But how they say boys will be boys, and they scratch out boys and put boys will be good humans. Well, what that implies is that those boys were not born good humans, and they need womankind to mold that boy into a good human, which I think is tragic because we don't have enough male teachers and we don't have enough, positive masculine men to, buck the trend and just basically say, you know what, screw you. I'm going to teach this kid how to be masculine and you guys just going to have to deal with it.
Well, I've seen that in the fitness sphere with there's, mm-hmm. It's a progressive social justice invaded fitness like everything else. I'm on the outs in that industry pretty much, mm-hmm. but there was
I think that's interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah. There's this trend towards guys where, some gentlemen I know in the fitness industry who've gotten successful where they're, they're kind of presenting themselves as a male role model now. Mm-hmm. But the emphasis is not on being a good man. It's on, let's just be good humans. It's not mm-hmm. about masculinity and femininity. It's about being a good human because we're all, equal. And it goes down, sort of the upper pill, but it's very blue pill. And even the guys that you could say are somewhat more masculine, they go sort of the purple pill route where they want to be universally appealing and, we don't want to upset the balance, so to speak, so they have to keep the message very watered down and still definitely.
Well, they want to be allies is what they want to be. They want to seem like they're, and that, again, that goes back to the deference to women. Like a lot of guys, when they have their, I always say everybody has game, okay? Everybody from the most rank beta to the least omega guy, he has some kind of idea how to go from being a lonely schmuck to being in a relationship or in intimacy with a woman. whether or not that's effective, obviously it's not, but whether or not that's effective is in question, but everybody has a game. So like you got these guys who've been brought up like in this feminine primary social order, and they have a game, just like you're talking about here. They think that by identifying with a woman and getting in touch with their feminine side and emoting like a woman and doing all these things that make them more alike, like with a woman, that's what I call identifying with that, to the point where they'll change their personalities and change their lives and change their ambitions so that they can better align with the feminine, because they think that that's the key to them getting laid. I think that's a key to them getting in a healthy, you know, egalitarian relationship. And then what's funny is like when guys are unplugging from that and they decide, you know what, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to be more masculine. I'm going to go the opposite way. I'm not going to try to be alike with a woman. I'm going to try to be different than a woman. Then suddenly they find out that, you know, they're so much more attractive, because it's the differences that draw us together. It's not that how much alike. A woman doesn't want to, unless she's a lesbian, a woman doesn't want to go and fuck another woman. She doesn't want to live or marry another chick. She wants to be with a guy. There's that difference in that. And I think that we do ourselves a really big disservice today by believing that like attracts like, and that we try so much to run what I call identity game, or to identify with women. And that's why I said that these guys don't, they want to be good humans, but they think that the definition of being a good human is to be more like a woman. And that's why they become allies. And that's why they become male feminists. Because no guy wakes up in the morning and goes, you know what? Women have really had it hard. I think I'm going to be a feminist today. There's a process that guy has to go through to come to the idea that he's better off as a male feminist than not as a male feminist. What is it that brought that guy to think in that respect? And what I would argue is that it is this want to align with women, to want to be more alike with women, because they think that that is the key to establishing some kind of intimacy or establishing some kind of intimate sexual connection with a woman. And that's probably a long-winded way of saying, well, feminists just aren't feminists because they want to get laid, right? Well, yes, but there's a whole lot more that goes along with that. When, you know, you got to understand these guys are like literally reprogramming their personalities because they believe so, you know, fervently in that.
Well, the thing I've raised, it's dangerous about, there's a morally righteous, there's a moralization component to it, where you've seen this, where it becomes, well, if to be a good man, where, you know, they're going to rewrite the definition, you know, to be a good man, you have to be a male feminist, and this makes you good. These are essentially like their commandments, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, and to violate that, it's not just a violation of, you know, you not liking women. It means, you know, you're evil. Mm-hmm. You're evil for not thinking this way.
And
the most fervent of them.
And then again, you know, think about the opposite side of that. If they don't identify with a woman, then it's this really this binary equation at that point. If I don't, then I'm going to be, if I'm not an ally of feminists, I must be a misogynist, right? Mm. You can't, that goes pretty much with any kind of really strict, movement type ideology, where it's one or the other, it's black or white. And that's true of a lot of different ideologies. But if you're wanting to avoid that, a lot of guys will say like, I don't want to think about myself first. I want to make sure that I'm there for her and I'm supportive and I'm doing this, because if they don't do that, she'll think I'm an asshole. She'll think I'm a jerk. She'll think I'm a selfish dude. I'm like, and I tell these guys, I said, what's the kind of guy that she's been fucking all this time, that she's been calling you on the phone and telling you what a jerk and what an asshole this guy is, but she keeps going back to that asshole, you know? It's a very common problem with these guys. You know, they end up becoming this emotional tampon for these girls. But the guy that this woman is with is the polar opposite of the guy she keeps saying that she wants to get with. And I would say, you know, it's the difference that it was, I think it was Royce said that the key to a healthy relationship is polarity. It's being different, and it's having and maintaining your own identities, and having that world, or having that frame that woman wants to come and enter into. And that is what I was talking about before, about how a woman, when she gets with a guy, it's very ego satisfying for her to know that she can get that type of guy. And the man that she's with, I really think that guys don't really wrap their heads around this entirely, that they represent the best that that girl could get. And if that's not true, then she's going to find somebody else, or you're going to be in a very unhappy situation. Even if she doesn't go look for somebody else, she's still going to think she could get better. And that's not going to make for a very healthy relationship, specifically when she wants somebody who's competent and she wants somebody who's dominant to make those decisions.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's kind of, you see that, like, I refer to this a lot, where I had a Periscope about this the other day, but I was talking about the Harlequin fantasy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, Harlequin romance novel. Mm-hmm. To the degree that feminism has tried to subvert the social reality, the female fantasy never changes still. You can see that, you know, you see it with those novels. You can see that in film. But what do women fantasize about? It's, yeah, man, there's complementarity to polarity. Mm-hmm. So he's a hyper masculine guy that is at of a sort of higher status level than her, but somehow they are equally attractive in some way. But she sort of has, it's always that interesting factor of like the undiscovered sexual market value. Mm-hmm. Like the beautiful girl, you know, sexually, like, you know, unruined, untouched, all men want her, hasn't been with anybody. And then the rogue, the dashing, you know, the pirate, the hero, he comes in and he is enraptured by her. And she is the one now that she is the one that he has to have. So the one night is fantasy still there. But at the same time, you have this preservation of, well, he is the man among men. So I got my alpha at the same time.
Right. Yeah.
And that's never changed.
He represents the apex to her hypergamy. And all of those, the classic romance novel is always a guy who is a beast. It's like Beauty and the Beast. Jordan Peterson brings this out. It's really an archetypal story for women. You can also see this happen in the Twilight series, and in even 50 Shades of Grey, really. The guy can't just be some rich dude. He has to have some mysterious and brooding about him, and there's got to be some sort of uncontrollability to that guy. He's got to be the beast from Beauty and the Beast, right? And she, through her, you know, her, even if she's just this plain Jane kind of woman, she has some kind of feminine intuition, and she knows how to reach this guy, and she knows how to tame Tarzan and turn him from this wild savage in the, you know, this sexual being in the jungle, and turn him into a gentleman, and turn him into a nobleman kind of thing. And that she's the only one that can do that. She's the only one that can bring that out. But, and I use this all the time, because Jordan Peterson likes to use the illustration of Beauty and the Beast. I go, yeah, that's true. Like, archetypally, that's 100% on. But remember, she falls in love with the beast. She doesn't fall in love with the prince. She doesn't fall in love with, you know, she wants Superman. She doesn't want Clark Kent. Clark might be a nice guy, but he is the opposite side of that Madonna whore, alpha fucks, beta bucks side of that equation. But the guy that she falls in love with has to be uncontrollable and has to be somebody that only she can uniquely tame. And I should also say that if you ever read the Twilight series or watch the movie, I've only seen one of the movies, or you look at the character development in 50 Shades of Grey, they're almost an identical story, because the woman who is in those stories is this very plain Jane, mousy, nothing really, nondescript the whole time. She's just sort of, they don't even give her any sort of description of what she looks like, or beyond the fact that she has some sort of magical intrinsic quality that turns, you know, Edward the vampire into her, you know, her ideal lover. And she has some magical way of doing that. And then that archetype also feeds into the archetype for today, when we ridicule men for being super masculine. Like when we have a macho guy, we say, oh, he must be gay. Or we have like the Homer Simpson archetype of the lovable but stupid and bumbling husband. Mm-hmm. And you see that in sitcoms all the time. I really have a tough time watching old reruns of Friends. Because if you look at the archetypes for the three males in that character, there's Joey, Chandler, and Ross in that. Ross is this, you know, sappy, horrible beta guy who's just a complete wimp. But yet, women love him.
I hate that show for many reasons.
You know, and then they've got Joey, who is this good-looking dude, you know, and is supposed to be an actor and a lady killer and everything. But he's stupid, you know, and he's... is not quite there. And really, I think Chandler sort of comes somewhere in between those two. Chandler's still beta, but he can't quite match Joey and his you know, his physique anyways. And whenever I look at those now through a red pill lens. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of ruined a lot of popular media for me to have around. I'm sure everybody listening to this understands that. When you see something these days and you look through a red pill lens, you're like, oh my God, I can't believe, you know, this is going on. But those archetypes go back to what you're talking about, where we have the bumbling idiot husband who has the woman who is the cure for his stupidity and helps him save himself from himself before, you know, through no other means than she has some magical feminine intuition to help him save himself from himself. And so again, that's sort of a play on that same romantic archetype.
Yeah, the thing with archetypes, I have to get this out before I lose it, but you know, what you're saying, like with the Beauty and the Beast story, where in all those fantasies where the woman falls in love with the beast, you know, the guy's always beastly in some manner or another, where he's savage, but he gets humanized because women, you know, it's always the female character never has any really special qualities to her that are, you could point out and say that's superlative. It's just by the fact of her being female, she, you know, it's representative of female mysticism, where women want you to think they're mystic.
Feminine mystique.
Yeah, feminine mystique. She has this feminine mystique about her that is based upon nothing, but it is. Mm-hmm. And then the beast archetype is humanized by it, mm-hmm. but he's only humanized for her. So he'll still go out and kill everybody.
Right. You know, well, and it puts the beast, it puts the alpha male, because you really, when you're looking at that, you're looking at the alpha archetype that the woman wants to breed with. She wants to have sex with, you know, not necessarily the prince might be somebody who can pay the bills and take care of the kids and, you know, make sure that they've got a roof over their head. She didn't want to fuck that guy. She wants to fuck the guy who's the beast. And the reason that that's the archetype is because you're looking at a woman who has to separate alpha fucks from beta bucks. And she's always going to, you know, beta bucks is almost always going to be there for an attractive woman. Even an average woman, beta bucks is pretty much going to always be there. So they're going to focus more on Tarzan rather than Clark Kent. And so what the archetypes are built upon is this, really is was hypergamy, which is the female sexual strategy, is what can I do to get this guy? It's the ultimate fantasy. They can get this perfect alpha dude who's going to be loyal only to them, mm-hmm. and is only going to want to have sex with them, and she completes him. And so in doing that, in that completion, he appreciates her. He finds something new about himself. Like there's always some part of him that's missing. There's always some kind of incompleteness to him that she magically, with her feminine wiles, can solve that problem for him. And that is, again, very, very ego gratifying for women. Like what we were just talking about how a woman associates her own personal value and associates her, you know, her ego with the kind of guy that she can get. And so here you have this woman who maybe she's attractive, but she's not like super, super attractive, but there's some magical, you know, feminine mystique quality about her that this guy is receptive to, and it fixes him. And so he's gone from being broken to being this perfectly, you know, the perfect mate for her, the guy who is the combination of alpha fucks and beta fucks. And really that's the gist, I think, really, of most romance novel, formulaic romance novels.
Yeah, I think on a transcendent level, the way I've characterized that is that it's, you know, the idea that, you know, the idea that you could take away patriarchy, it's so ingrained into literally the DNA of human beings where the most powerful thing a woman can do, and, you know, in fantasy and fairy tale and, you know, on a transcendent level, the most powerful thing a woman can do is to get a powerful man. Mm-hmm. That's the power. That's the ultimate power for those stories, the Beauty and the Beast archetype, right? I liked the way Pearson characterized it as being sort of this typical female fantasy where, you know, for the man, it's being the hero. For the woman, it's being Belle. What did you get? You got the most powerful man. You got the most powerful thing in the universe, basically, mm-hmm. with all the gravity, with everything that an ideal masculine figure could be. You got it to fall for you. And now you complete it.
Right. Well, again, and it goes back to the feminine mystique, but also a need on the part of women to just by virtue of being a woman, be more powerful than a man. Because what do we say? We say men conquer worlds and women conquer men. And so if you can conquer the man, if you can conquer the agency that can go out and conquer the world, then, you know, that makes you more powerful than anything else in the world. And you're talking about women who are intrinsically, innately weaker than men, but there's that want or that desire to be in control of a chaotic world. They want to be in control of their security. They want to be in control of, you know, having their selection or having their pick of the alpha fucks that they want to have. They want to have the control to make sure that their beta bucks or their security, their long-term security side is matched with their short-term sexual side. And really, when you look at where we've come since in society-wise, when you look at how we've gone from the sexual revolution up until where we are today, we put pretty much progressively layer after layer, put more and more control into the hands of women. Whereas the women don't want that control. They only want to be able to control the man so that the man can do it for them so that they're free to do whatever, feel powerful in a dangerous situation, even though they're not responsible for that protection.
Yeah, well, they don't want the responsibility that comes with it. I mean, that's why there's certain, you know, there's certain avenues of professions that are never going to be female oriented. Yeah, you know, military. Nobody wants to see women with guns getting shot. Mm-hmm. We want to say that you can be. No one wants to see that, but at the same time, well, a woman could do that if she wanted to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but you won't.
And that's a fantasy too. Is that, again, that's a power fantasy that a woman can be everything. She can have both sides of her, you know, masculine and feminine be in complete alignment with each other. And we always talk about, I mean, really since the sexual revolution, we've talked about how men need to get in touch with their female side. And so we feminize men and we masculinize women. And really what we're doing is if you're going to put, it goes against nature, first of all. It goes against our evolved natures in the first place. What were we just talking about? We're just talking about how women are innately attracted to dominance and decision-making and competence within a man. They're not attracted to a guy who's this weak, you know, meek, harmless, you know, harmless guy. They're not interested in that. But, you know, when you look at why are they not interested in that? Because we evolved from 100,000 years ago to seek competency in men, to seek that power, to want to have sex with the men who have the highest, you know, physical prowess of anybody else. And of course that creates a dominance hierarchy. And then that really women are the real responsible party for patriarchy, is because by doing that, by selecting based on those criteria, you know, you're not going to get them to select something that goes against their inborn evolved arousal and attraction cues. You're just not going to do that. It's just not how our brains are wired up to do that. And if you do, you're going to have a woman who is constantly struggling against that and has this internal conflict where she's going against wanting that guy that her evolutionary, you know, imperatives say that she should be with. And then her cognitive, you know, rational mind is saying, well, you know, it's okay that guys are weak. It's okay that guys are vulnerable. It's okay that guys are, you know, you got this two warring factions and what she's been taught and what her innate nature really wants from that guy. And I think we see that again, like in the G.I. Jane fantasy. Well, we want to be as tough as guys, or we want to be as powerful as guys, because, and we want to live lives that mirror what we think guys' lives are like. And so that means being able to commit to a career, because it's so, you know, if the men have it and they have more power, then they want that too. And they want to be the ones that are involved in a lot of the, you know, the same masculine activities that men have always been a part of, because they see that as a route to power. Mm-hmm. And then from that, they apply that thinking, that masculine is best thinking, to a lot of different other aspects of their lives. So when women get to be, you know, what I call it, just past their epiphany phase, or they're just past the wall, and they start asking, where are all the good men at? Why can't I find a guy who's smart and educated and who's on my level or higher, my hypergamous level or higher? How come I can't find those guys? Because those guys who exist don't want to have anything to do with you because you're too much like a man. Again, goes back to the differences that make the attraction, not not how alike we are. So women base their attraction parameters and their measurements based on what they would necessarily be for a man. So if a man is got status and a man has a good job and a man has all of these things that she wants and that she went to college for and she went and did all this thing so she could follow in the life plan of a man. And then she says, well, where are the good men at? Well, of course not, because you've made yourself into a man for the last, you know, 10 or 12 years in your schooling and everything else. You think that that's where you want to go, and you're expecting men to be attracted to what attracts women in men.
I've trained a lot. I've had a lot of female clients. Mm-hmm. That I found fascinating. So when I was training, I was training clients in Hollywood, had women like in their 30s, this exact conversation, stereotypical to a T, 35, not married. You know, I can't find any good guys. I don't understand. And, you know, then I was with a guy a few years back, but he wanted me to stop working. He wanted to take care of me. I wasn't going to do that because I have my career. Mm-hmm. You know, they hit the wall. They passed the wall. Yeah. And then it's this you know, horrifying realization where I've had so many women break down crying about this in the process of training, where you're the female criteria that, you know, looks are not everything. It's personality. It's all these things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Obviously women are selecting for a lot of different competencies. Men are selecting for, not to be overly reductionist, but attractiveness
and sexual availability.
Yeah, sexual availability, age. Mm-hmm. Do I get along with her? Am I going to have to put up with a dude chick who's 36? And then when they have that realization that, oh, men don't select women the way women select men. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I heard that complaint so often. All the guys now, they only want to date 20-year-olds. What, you know, what pigs to want to, you know, have sex with?
Because because the 20-year-olds have everything that they're attracted to, and they're not, you know, hopefully God forbid at 20, that you're this really careerist, you know, quote unquote alpha female, which I don't believe in, but, I think that, yeah, exactly. When they get to be 35 years old and they're suddenly having this realization that they're not, you know, the criteria for female attraction is not the same as it is for men, then they're like, holy shit, what do I do? And you're talking about a woman who has been raised to be a man, more or less, or to be masculinized, and then to just even say, hey, you need to become more feminine. That's like me telling a guy who has made women his mental point of origin for his entire life, you need to make yourself your mental point of origin. It's the same dynamic, because basically what I'm saying is you've been living your life wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's a hard pill to swallow, man, especially for women who are constantly empowered. They're constantly told, you know, you go girl and you can have it all and you can do this and you could still have a career and have a family and you can do all this stuff, and they're constantly empowered. And even when they're depressed and even when all of that comes crashing down on them, there's still even more social support and social conventions that builds them right back up again. So to tell a woman you need to be more feminine and you need to look better and you need to offer something more than just what a careerist woman can offer, and that's insulting to them in the first place, because it's telling them they've lived their lives the wrong way. But you say, hey, look, you know, the proof is right here. And guys, you know, you can shame guys all you want for liking girls between the ages of 21 and 24 years old. The fact of the matter is that's what they're attracted to, and that's what they're going to go for. I think it was Black Label Logic was he's got a really great book. If you haven't read it, it's Gendernomics.
Yeah.
He does a lot of quotes from this other book called Dataclism, which was all this sort of dating information that was made public through OkCupid.com. And women rate the vast, vast majority of men as being unattractive, like physically unattractive. It was sad, because, you know, we always say, well, you know, it's the 80-20 rule, you know, 20% of men are attractive and 80% are betas. And blah, blah. I would almost argue that it's closer to like 93-7.
I think it's more, you know, it's funny. I think it's more of I was thinking about this the other day. Since someone asked me, like, you've used online dating. I'm like, I have, but I was thinking about, I'm like, I'm probably in that 20%, and I realized I'm like, it's more of a power law, honestly. Like, it's like a 90-10 distribution.
Yeah, yeah. And so you got that, and then you've got the other stats where they ask men from ages like 18 to about 50 or 60, maybe even 70. I think they went pretty old. What is the age in which you find the opposite sex most attractive? And then they did the same thing for women. And for women, it was usually about a 5 to 7 year difference between the two. They always wanted a guy who was older than them, 5 to 7 years older. Some cases a little more, some cases a little less, but mostly about a 5 to 7 year distribution. So if a woman is 30 years old, she finds a guy 35 to 37, right? The thing for men is it never changes. The guy who is 18 years old, they all seek women who are between the ages of what I call the sexual market peak for women, which is right 22 to 24, right? 22, 23, 24, right in that range for every single age, all the way up to 70. The guy who's 70, he finds the woman who's 23 the most attractive. And a guy who's 50, guy who's 40, guys who's 20, all of them find that demographic the most attractive, and it doesn't change. And women, of course, think that this must be a result of these poor men being socialized to think that, that it's a social construct. All women become social constructivists when it comes to why men are after younger, hotter, and tighter. Uh-huh. It's simply, I mean, really the simple, stupid answer is that we're evolved that way, and we're looking for youth, and we're looking for fertility. That's what we're looking for naturally. But they want to say, well, it's because, you know, magazine covers, and it's because of bikini models, and it's because of strippers, and it's because of porn, and it's because of anything that would possibly shame a man for wanting younger, hotter, and tighter, and completely ignoring the fact that it's just simply our natural predilections to want women like.
Well, they're in the prime of their breeding window. Something I don't know if you've ever identified with this. I've known lots of women where, like, it's not the wall. It's like the 25 crisis. Mm-hmm. I've had this happen so many times at work. It's been a noble phenomena for me where the sexual market value prime is, let's say, like, you know, 21 to 24. You got 20 to 24. You got like a 5 year window. At 25, I've had this conversation just infinitely where. It's this question of, I've asked outright, am I still in my prime? Am I 20? Like, this women I've known. Yeah, Alexander, am I still in my prime? Like, I just turned 25. Am I still in my prime? Yeah, I feel like I'm not hot. I feel like I'm not as hot as I used to be. Mm. You know, I'm not going to say they decline, but it's just women have that internal, they have that observational realization where they can look themselves at 25 and they realize it. Yeah, 21. I mean, unless they've really taken care of themselves, I was probably a little bit skinnier and a little bit hotter. And they can see that. I think it's the first time they can actually see the difference from a longevity standpoint, where they are getting older. And yes, you are not going to be as hot as you age. You're not.
Yeah,
it's right around 25, 28, and then right in that window.
That's simple pragmatism finally creeping up on women. I think that pretty much all women realize that they hit a peak. Right about the time that I say they do, really, between 22 and 24 years old. And, you know, oddly enough, that happens to be the same place that the dataclysm stats show. But I have, in the second book in Preventive Medicine, I don't know if you've read it, but, the whole book is pretty much based on a timeline that I created from a woman who is 15 years old till she's about 50 years old. And some people criticize me for going that young, and some people criticize me for not going older. But I figure, you know, that's right. You know, 15 is right about the time that, you know, boys start taking interest in girls sexually. So you kind of have to include that. And then what they're primarily interested in during those various phases of their maturity. So when you got a girl who is between 15 and maybe 23, 24, right before the 25 threshold you're talking about, they're primarily concerned with looks when it comes to guys. They're looking for that alpha look. And it's all about short-term breeding at that point. It's all about hitting it before they're out of that prime fertility window. And I told my daughter this, and she completely understands that. I said, look, when you get to be 22 years old, 23, that is going to be as hot as you are ever going to be in your lifetime. And, you know, I'm sure there's people who are going to watch this going, oh my God, I can't believe he said that to his daughter. But she understands that because she's a model and she's been a pageant girl. And so she's a very, very attractive, I mean, toot my own horn, but my wife's a very attractive woman, and I don't think I'm a slouch either, but she got the really good genetics and is a model and very good looking. I told her, I said, you know what? Use that to your best ability once you get to, you know, into your prime. She's read my books before. I said, you know, use that to your best ability when you get to that, because afterwards, you know, you're going to be looking back on that time and trying everything you do from 25, 26, 27, 28, all the way up to the rest of your life. It will be in an effort to get back to that time when you were at your hottest, which was, you know, 22, 23 years old. I said, I'm not trying to say this to depress you. I'm just giving you the facts and telling you what it's going to really be like. And that doesn't mean that women aren't hot when they, you know, I know some pretty, I like to think my own wife is pretty hot, but I look at, you know, women who are in their 40s and they can take care of themselves. I look at, you know, I think that's one of the things that's frustrating some of your clients, really, is that they go and they put out the effort and they try to look good and they try to get back into the intrasexual competition. And they're still struggling against that because their 35-year-old self is not ever going to be as hot as their 25-year-old self was, because men base their arousal and their attraction on younger, hotter, tighter. So all the stuff that guys do to get, you know, status, good looks, like we were talking about, like for men during their peak, it takes longer for a man to mature into the highest potential he's going to have. And I always say that's right around 34 to 36 years old, I think, for guys. Takes longer because you need to be a better judge of character. You need to have, you know, hopefully you've got some money together. Hopefully you've got your more complete package than you could have been when you're 25 years old. But getting back to what you're saying, I think that, yeah, I think right about that time is when women start to really consciously acknowledge that they're not going to be able to keep up in the game as well as they have been. And that's why I say, you're probably familiar with my term, the epiphany phase.
Yep.
I say when a woman gets to be about, I think the latest is 29 to 31 years old, women are in their epiphany phase. And that's when they say, oh, I need to get my life together. I need to stop, you know, having sex with all these bad boys. I need to find them. Where are the nice guys? That's when you hear the vast majority of women say, where are the nice guys? Why can't I find the right guy? Why can't I find the right guy? And, you know, Rolo, where are the nice guys? Where are the good guys? And it's like, they're back in your 20s where you left them.
Where have all the good men gone?
Yeah, that's what they're back in your 20s, where you didn't want to have anything to do with them at the time. But they go through that kind of crisis. It's really, I call it a sort of a mirror. The epiphany phase is really a mirror to men's midlife crisis, if you want to even call it that. I don't really like calling it a midlife crisis. I think of it, again, as an epiphany for men, because guys who get into that midlife crisis, but it's, like I said, it's a revelation for them to understand where they've been and what they're doing, you know, and how they've been, you know, especially if they're divorced or they're, you know, they're single parents or something like that. And they begin to realize their role in the game that women had for them that they played along in. And now they have the choice to get out of that game or to keep going along with that game. And I think that's really sort of the epiphany phase for men. But for women, it's oh my God, I can't compete with the women that I used to compete with. And I need to find a long-term guy and cash out of the casino before I can't do that anymore. And so that's when women go, okay, I'm going to make this guy wait 3 dates before I have sex with him. Okay, I'm going to get myself right with God. I'm going to, I'm done with the bad boys. I've learned my lesson. They haven't learned any lesson.
I'm a good girl now.
Yeah, I'm a good girl now. They haven't learned anything like that. What that is that's their subconscious saying, oh my God, I better, you know, find somebody in the long term, because if I don't, I'm not going to have kids. I'm not going to have the family. I'm not going to do those things that I wanted to. And that's coincides, I should say, with the statistics that show that women and, well, even men, like, you know how they say the marriage, the age of marriage has increasingly got more older and older and older. So right now the average age of marriage is 27 years old for men and women. I would suggest that even in the future, we're going to see that's going to get even older. Mm-hmm. So right about that time is when women go through their epiphany phase. And I think that probably the girl you were talking about, the 25-year-old, she might have been just sort of coming to that really tough, you know, cognizant realization that it's the party's not going to go on forever, and she's going to have to find some way out.
Well, I mean, I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and you know, LA is filled with beautiful women. There's mm-hmm. always new women coming in, they're hotter and younger.
So
every beauty queen moves to LA to be an actress, model, singer, whatever. So you have these women, they're like, yeah, they're hot in their mid to late 20s, but then they're seeing the early 20 girls move in. Mm-hmm. They have that realization. And it's funny, I've read the volume 2, Preventive Medicine, but I referenced a scale at some time in a Periscope where I was referring for a gentleman to have an understanding where women's preferences will change as they age. Mm-hmm. You said this yourself, from 15 to through high school, I want a hot alpha guy that's hot. Mm-hmm. It's very basic. Then you get into the early 20s, and then it's still mostly looks driven and having fun. But then 25 is that threshold period where it's like, these girls are a bit hotter than me now. Maybe I need to be more relationship minded, especially if they're single and they've been single, 25, 26, 27. But then they can still kind of have the ego defenses kick in because they have the social condition that tells them that, you're still a catch. You're going to get hotter when you turn 30, dirty 30, all that BS. But then inevitably the wall happens. And for the guys that are still single at that time, I think in a way sometimes you have these, there's a certain subset of men where they're relationship minded, maybe in their 20s, they want to be with a girl. And they get into their later 20s and they start realizing just kind of by default, you know what? It's easier to date now. I'm more of a catch at 29, 30 than I am at 22. Oh, this is kind of cool. Younger girls are easier to get along with than older women. That's kind of cool. I've had that happen myself. I turned 20 this year. The older I've gotten, the more, and I couldn't even ascribe it to being intentional. The older I've gotten, the more, I want to say control over the dynamic, but the more enjoyable the dynamic is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's more of a natural polarity.
I think a lot of that, when I go into a lot of detail, especially in Preventive Medicine, about the stages of maturity that a woman goes through, but there's also a definite progression that men go through too. And like, I think you're sort of discovering that right now. One of the reasons I tell guys to, don't make such a big deal out of your one-itis when you're 19 years old, or you're even when you're 23 years old, and don't go and slit your wrist because some girl left you. It's because, you're still not even at your peak potential yet. Even you are not at your peak potential yet. And I can only see that going up, but you're starting to make that realization that it's easier now. And because you're making that realization, you're more confident in it because I've been with enough women that I know that, I hate to use the stupid bus analogy, but if I miss this bus, another one's going to come along and I'm going to be good because men, you're right. Men become more and more of a catch the older that they get because they have more maturity and they have more, confidence is a sort of a byproduct of that, but they have, like I said, they're a better judge of character. They establish themselves in with who they are with themselves, and then also in their work and their ambitions, and hopefully they've achieved something. I'm not saying everybody has to be a lawyer or something like that, but I'm just saying hopefully you've achieved some of the ambitions that you made for yourself. And you're starting to hit your stride, right around 34, 35, 36 years old. I have a post called The Epiphany Phase and the Jenny Bond Experience or something like that. And it was about this poor girl who was 30 years old and she was dating this guy who was 36. And she's at an age in her epiphany phase where she wants to, cash out. And she's been dating this one guy and she's a model too. And she's pretty attractive for 30. She just turned 30. And, she's trying to get this guy to commit because the guy's a catch. And why is he a catch? He's a catch because he's hitting his stride at 37 years old, something like that. And she's wanting to lock him down. And his, the whole article she wrote was about how he wouldn't do it because he's like, I've never been in such a position of being the prime selector of being able to say who I want to go with and who I want to spend the rest of my life with. And he's like, no offense, you're a good looking girl, but what do you bring to the table that, that I can't get from somebody else who's better? It seems really insulting for women, but the thing is that women have prioritized themselves sexually to make themselves sexual commodities for so long that there's nothing else to them. And they're forcing men to really see women as only as a sexual commodity. So when a guy gets to a point in his life where he's the sexual selector, like you were talking about before, I don't necessarily agree that women are the only sexual selectors. Yeah, women can go out and get laid if they want to on a Saturday night, if they want to go, hey, I'm giving it up for free. They, yeah, they can go, sure, they can go do that. Mm-hmm. But who are they having sex with, and what is the result of that, and really, and what's prompting that too? But the older that a guy gets, and the older that, you know, like yourself, is you're a really good example. So, you know, you've got yourself together, you've got the business together, you're obviously red pill aware. You've got a lot going for you. You will represent, what are you, 29 right now?
Yeah, 2 weeks or
so you're not even 30 yet, but once you, watch out, man, because right now you need to protect yourself, because women will look at that and they'll go, this guy's, he's good looking, he's got his shit together, and he's got a business, and he's down to earth, and oh man, why can't, you know, where are all the good guys? There he is right there. You know, they could very easily do that, but what they'll try to do is lock you down. They'll accidentally get pregnant with you. They'll try to find, you know, duplicitous ways to get you into committing. I mean, did you know that there are like online forums of women who do nothing but discuss exactly what I'm talking about right now? Like, how can I lock this dude down? There is a black market. Did you know this? There's a black market for positive birth control or birth tests or pregnancy tests right now. So if a woman pees on a stick and it's pink or whatever, she can go and she can put that up on this black market and say, okay, it's going for X amount of dollars, so that some other woman who's not pregnant can show it to their man and get him to, you know, by fraud, get him to commit more. And there's no laws against that. That's not a criminal act. You can sell that, and nobody is regulating this, and nobody's calling this shit out. Yeah. You gotta be fucking careful at that time.
I had a female client that like women. It's funny when you're like a red pill wear guy. Women will open up to you about stuff they would never tell a blue pill guy. They you know they will if you can get them comfortable. I had a female client. I remember we had a good relationship. I trained her after she just had her second child. She told me outright, you know, like we were discussing her, you know, she's like, I've been married X amount of time. Like, how'd you guys meet? She said outright, she's like, I will totally tell you, I purposely got pregnant without telling him. Mm-hmm. I told him I was on the pill because I wanted to lock him down, because he was high level finances, you know, worked in, private equity. She was, you know, young. She's like, I knew that I was like getting like past my peak. Mm-hmm. I want to say she was like 27. They're on there.
Right in that epiphany phase.
No, she lied out. She's like, and we're laughing about it, but at the same time, it's kind of like a dark humor too. I'm thinking in my head, like, oh my God. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she had no sense of regret. Obviously, mm-hmm. They're married, they're happy, let's say. She's from her friend. She's like, yeah, I told him I was on the pill, I wasn't. And then I made him just, you know, get on top of me a whole bunch of times one weekend, and then I got pregnant with our first child. Then he had to marry me.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? Like I said, there are internet forums dedicated to figuring that out and how to, and it's like they'll throw a party, you know, once the guy, you know, once they lock down a guy, you know, doing exactly, basically it's birth fraud is what it is. And so I always tell guys, I say, you know, you guys, you really need, especially when you get into that, you're dealing with a woman who's in her epiphany phase and you are maybe 33 years old and you have some, you have some prospect to you, some potential to you, man, be careful, because women, first of all, they know that you have that selective capacity there. So when a woman is in like her peak sexual phase, like, you know, right about 23 years old. Yeah, definitely. They are the selectors right then. They, you know, men display, women select, and she's going to go out with who she's going to have sex with, whoever the hell that she wants to have sex with, because she's the one that has, at no other point in her life will she have more selective capacity than at that point. And I think that guys, the evil trick is that we condition guys to be these poor blue pill pre-whipped guys, so that there's these perfect these perfect dupes when they get to be 30 years old and they don't know any better, and suddenly all these girls are really into them and they think that their ships come in. You know, they think, oh man, all these girls who would never have anything to do with me. Well, now I finally, and it's an ego boost for them, because they stuck to the plan and they made something of themselves. I think they made something of themselves, and they made X amount of dollars per year, and they don't understand that they're not being selected on the criteria of alpha fucks. They're being selected on the criteria of what they think long-term security and parental investment is going to be. And that's another thing I think that sort of gets mixed up in the mix there, is like women will go and they'll get pregnant with a guy, like an alpha guy, and they're, you know, say they're 24 years old, then they get to be you know, 30 years old, 31 years old, and they expect some blue pill guy to come and invest in the kid that she had sex with the guy that she, you know, the alpha that she fucked when she was in her 20s in her party years. And so, you know, really what I call that is retroactive cuckoldry. Mm-hmm. So you're taking that guy and you're expecting another guy to raise that man's child, knowing full well that that guy was never going to be a great father, but you wanted to have sex with him and you wanted to have a kid with him. But you're expecting this poor blue pill guy at 30 years old to come over and take over the responsibilities for that. And how do they do that? They make the guy out to be a hero. Oh, well, he stepped up and adopted this kid and he really fell in love with me and my children. And, you know, we have a great life. You know, in the back of her head, she knows that, you know, this guy is really just footing the bill for the alpha that she had sex with before. And that's another really duplicitous side of this whole thing. But yeah, I mean, in your situation, man, you have to be so, so careful because they know this. They know that shit's going down.
I had a point in my early 20s. I was like 22. I was dating a much older woman. She's like, it was like 22, 32. She's 10 years older. Mm-hmm. And I remember we're like a few weeks into it. And yeah, I was 22 then. So like I'm still in my blue pill phase, kind of like I'm like transitioning out of it, you know, learning how to be, you know, or kind of like letting the alpha come forth. But I remember we had this morning where like we woke up fucked and I was like, I gotta go to work. And mm-hmm. she's just fiercely pissed off. She's like, what are you, she's like, are you not going to cuddle me? You're not going to, like, I have to leave. I have like, look at my, like the watch just be my, I have like an 8 a.m. appointment. Like I have to go. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yeah, like my career is the most important thing to me. Uh-huh. And that one statement though, when I said that, just set off a fury.
Oh yeah.
Career's the most important thing. I'm like, yeah, because like, yeah. Yeah, I was not so beta. I was not so blue pill. I was that for. I'm like, yeah, because it's making me money, and why wouldn't it be? She's like, what about me? I'm like, you're number two. Like, my most important thing in my life is me.
Yeah,
it was just, that was like a week-long argument. Their relationship did not last, but wanted to lock down the younger guy. Uh-huh. I had a lot going for me then, you know.
What's funny is that is a good illustration of what I was talking about before, how women expect men to defer to women. They expect, she expected your priority to be her, not you. And why? Because she's probably lived for, you know, the last 25 years with guys just kissing her ass and wanting to be, you know, prioritizing her in their mental point of origin as opposed to themselves. Yeah. Why not? That's good.
Yeah, it was a good RP moment for me. Just so I realized, I thought about it afterwards, you know, like especially later on, I'm like, she really thought I was going to say her. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then she had that male conditioning. I realized I'd put myself in that position where I was like, okay, like younger guy, older woman. But I had a really good corporate career, so I think, you know, prior, you know, in her head, her mind, she's like, well, I'm older, I'm past my prime, but I got a really, 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 really hot guy. Okay. I need to lock down immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah, that I mean, that relationship lasted like 8 weeks. So
yeah. Great. Hey, well, we've been going for 2 hours here.
Yeah, I was about to say, I'm like, this has been we've covered a lot of ground with this. So.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Can we make this available to everybody?
Listen? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm gonna take the audio for it, and then I'll take the audio. I'm thinking about putting the video on YouTube too, and then yeah, I'll post up later today. So. Okay.
All right. Let me just say one thing before we break though, is I want you to go to the 21 convention. Like I said, I suggested you to Anthony and I think that would be really good because I really think that the one thing about the convention now anyways, is it's really gone from kind of this purple pill kind of wishy-washy thing to really being much more red pill and much more focused in this direction right now. And I was just discussing this with Anthony not too long ago. I think it is unique in that it brings together guys from all over the manosphere. So we got a guy who's going to talk about, you know, being in a marriage guy. We got pickup artist guys. We got fitness guys such as yourself. I'm there. I'm just the philosophy, psychology side of things. We have the self-improvement guys. There's just so much crossover between the speakers who are going to be at this. And that's why I really wanted to get you involved in this. I mean, we have some other guys who are more physique, you know, they're into workout and nutrition and stuff like that too, but I don't think they do it quite the way that you do it. where you're more of like a, you're more of like a Zen kind of guru guy, you know, like where it's more like a spirit. Like I was going to say that when I saw the Jesse Peterson video with you, I was like, I learned more about you in that one video. I was like, damn, I didn't know he was Jewish.
there's certain stuff I don't talk about. And I mean, that's why, like,
he draws it out of you.
Yeah. He did a good job. Like, being in the fitness industry, I'm like, I never wanted that career. So, like, a lot of what interests me more so is it's a philosophy, psychology side of things.
Yeah. And so you bring a different angle to it, which I think I think a lot of people, a lot of guys can benefit from, but we have so much going on. That's why I was hoping you were going
to
tell me, are you confirmed? Did you know if you're going to do it or not?
Yeah, I'm going to confirm with them.
Cool. So anyways, you can find my stuff at therationalmail.com. You already know that.
Put in the show notes. You're
probably going to list this anyways, but you can just look up The Rational Mail on Amazon and you'll find all three of my books. And if anybody wants to talk to me one-to-one, I'm on Twitter at Rolo Tomasi at Rational Mail.
Awesome.
I just like to throw those out there. So.
Yeah. Oh, of course. I'm going to link all your stuff and all this. Yeah. So. Awesome, my man.
Well, cool, man. All right. It was good to talk to you. We got to do this again. Hey, I would really like to, just before we quit here, I would like to get you to come and be a speaker on one of our Red Band group chats where we've got we get together five guys and the topics vary, but we're just, for right now, it's really just guys that I think would be good. I think you'd certainly be good on it. And then speakers from the convention.
I'd totally be up for it.
Yeah. Cool. All right, man.
Good to talk to you. Talk to you again.
Yeah. Okay. We'll see you.
Adios.